Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's August 8, 2016, and this is episode 535. I recently had the pleasure of sitting down for a chat with my friend, photographer David Duchemin, briefly about the second edition of his best-selling book, Within the Frame, and then about his beautiful new underwater photography. I will, of course, include the photographs in the enhanced edition of this podcast, but if you can't see that, go to the blog at mbp.ac/535 to follow along with the beautiful work that David shares and talks with us about. Okay, so let's jump right in. Here's my conversation with David Duchemin. So, David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Martin. It's good to talk to you again.
You too. It's always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So, you've been busy with a whole bunch of projects. And today we're going to talk about your recent underwater work. I know this is something that you've been sort of gradually being dragged into over the last few years, by yourself, of course. But we're going to talk about that. But I also know that you've just updated your best-selling book, Within the Frame. So I want to talk a little bit about that before we jump into the main topic. Tell us a little bit about Within the Frame. What's it about?
Well, it started, I don't even know when was it, 2009 when I started working on it. And the idea was, the idea started as just another crappy travel photographer's book. and then I realized the world needed precisely zero more of those. and I started to ask myself, if I could do this, you know, my way, whatever that was, I didn't know. But if I could just think outside of whatever boxes I was currently thinking in and just dream up the book that I would like to do. It started to come out as a book about the passionate photography of people, places, and culture. And the only reason I say the passionate photography is because I didn't want to do another book that was yet about here's how to get your gear from A to B, here's how to compose for a travel photograph, because composition for travel photography is the same as composition for anything else. And I realized that the thing that to me, anyway, that was missing from so many of these books was the passion. And now, of course, having written so many books and used the word vision so many times, I'm not even sure I know what it means sometimes. Now looking backwards, of course, you know, the word vision is everywhere. But at the beginning, people, the books that were out there in the photographic world or the popular photographic world were not talking about vision. They were talking about how things were done, not why things were done. Mm-hmm. And when they were talking about how, it was very much about f-stops and shutter speed. And while those things were important, I wanted a book that, at least if we were going to talk about shutter speeds and f-stops, talked about why we were choosing particular ones and what kind of feeling we were putting into photographs and treating people with respect when we photographed them. And something that was just maybe a book that was a little more human than it was technical.
Mm.
And so that's, in the end, that is what Within the Frame, the journey of photographic vision became, a book that is more than just about travel photography, but that is kind of a book that couldn't decide whether it was really about vision or really about photographing people, places, and culture. Hmm. But in the end, I think found a balance between both.
Yeah. I remember reading Within the Frame. I was still the last year in my old day job or last year or so. And I remember reading it during my commute and stuff like that. And it was one of those books that for me that really, it changed a lot of the way I thought. And I'm sure it's the same for a lot of people. I remember because at the time, I think that was when I really started to hear your name. I'd maybe heard of you before that, but I think it was Within the Frame that launched you into sort of the lofty area that you're at now. And I'm saying that kind of tongue in cheek because I know you hate that crap. But I think for me that was one of the things that launched you into the limelight as it was. But I remember really just feeling, thinking how, and you've continued to be so eloquent. And I was thinking, you know, this guy is giving photographers a vocabulary again, because I think we'd kind of lost that in, you know, the first sort of 10 years of nine years of digital, when it was becoming so instant. And I remember reading through, and the way you worded a lot of the stuff in the book, it made me feel as though you were giving the photography world a vocabulary again, a way to talk about photographs. And that kind of set the stage for the rest of the stuff that you've done. So it was a great book to learn more about you, but also to really enhance the photography industry in a time when I feel it was sort of flattening out a little bit.
Well, that's high praise. Thank you. Yeah, I think you're right, and I think it's what I aimed to do. I never in a million years imagined that I would achieve it, but it's, you know, it pleases me to think. What my goal was when I wrote this book. I remember saying to my publisher, "I have no expectations. I just want to write a book that to some people is important. I wanted it to be more than just the same old stuff." And but, you know, my voice, I think when you say gave us a vocabulary again, I think you're expressing it rightly, because I am not by any stretch of the imagination the first guy to talk about this stuff. In fact, you know, the more I dig into some of the photographers of the past, you know, Andreas Feininger and Henri Cartier-Bresson and Ansel Adams and, you know, all of these past masters who, I don't know, they were writing. They didn't seem, when they wrote, to be quite so obsessed about the technology of it. Maybe they just didn't feel there was much more to talk about. You know, I mean, there was f-stops and apertures and what, you know, how you focus your camera. And after that, it was very low tech. So then they actually talked about the craft, but they've all been saying similar things. I sort of shake my head every time I read one of these books. I think, you know, even though I thought at the time some of these thoughts were new and I wasn't very well exposed to some of these masters at the time, the more I read, the more I think, you know, I'm in very good company. It's nice to be reading that stuff and finding these thoughts echoed, because I feel a little bit less like the crazy guy on the corner, you know, who's ranting that the end is nigh. And I feel like at least there's a few more of them. I don't remotely believe the end is nigh, but I, you know, I'm the one on the corner yelling, vision is better. And now at least I feel like I'm joined. Maybe they're all crazy, but at least I feel I'm in company of some crazy people who made some beautiful photographs.
Yeah. And you know, I've recently, last year, I think it was, or earlier this year, I read Ansel Adams' The Negative. And I recently had to put an order in Amazon.com, and I bought the other two of that three-part series. And I haven't read them yet. I've got them sitting here next to me. Just behind me. But as I was reading The Negative, I was sitting there every few minutes, I was chuckling to myself, because he was saying stuff that's still so very relevant. But because of the time, the times that we live in now, people don't bother reading those books anymore. They think it's old stuff. But physics hasn't changed. And a lot of the stuff that he was talking about is still so relevant. You can almost imagine him, if you just changed a few words, like changing film for sensor and stuff like that, it would still be just as relevant today. So I totally understand what you're saying. So obviously your expectations weren't that high for Within the Frame, but it went bestseller. And you've obviously, it excelled your initial expectations. But now, so what, 7-8 years on, you have decided to really, you know, you did a new edition and you've just released the second edition of Within the Frame.
Yeah.
What compelled you to do the update?
Well, you know, in the book itself, I talk about how vision is, vision evolves and changes as we do. And several years on, my vision, and it certainly has evolved and changed. I think matured is a better way to put it. I think I've learned a lot in the last, 8 years or whatever, since, what's the math? I don't know. It came out in 2009 or something. So it's, you know, enough time has passed that I like to think that there has been some maturing on my part. And with that, And the fact that the publisher was open to doing a new edition came the opportunity to update some things that were now more reflective of my vision. So in part, that was taking all the photographs out and reprocessing all of them, taking a number of them out. And, you know, for example, there were a number of duotoned images in within the frame that were treated with sort of purples in the shadows and warmth in the highlights. And at the time, I quite liked it. And now it really no longer reflects how I feel about those scenes. I think maybe at the time I was trying to bring a little bit of pop to the images, when in reality, most of them, the moment is strong enough that they don't need that. And so I retreated them in a black and white that was, a little bit contrasty, but very appropriate to the way I've always seen my black and white work. And then there were just some occasions in the book where I probably 25% of the images are new. I just took out old images that I thought, well, they're not as strong, and replaced them with newer work. And, you know, in the case of some, you know, I said this at one point in the book, I said, you know, I don't do a lot of landscape photography. Well, in the time between writing the book and now, I've done an awful lot of landscape photography. So I updated that a little bit, added a little bit more landscape photography. And it really was just a chance for me to create a more mature version of Within the Frame. And then, of course, you know, the practicality of that is it gives me an opportunity to release it as a new release to a new audience. As you said with Ansel Adams books, you don't have to look as far back as Ansel Adams. I think most of us look on Amazon, and if a book has been published, quite a while ago, it's like, is it still relevant? I'm not sure. And which, of course, is nonsense. Yeah, of course, physics doesn't change. Well, the visual language doesn't change. And so in that way, we should all be sort of exploring the back catalogs of some of the stuff and being open to learning from even the dead guys. But the reality is that some people don't do that. And certainly the booksellers, after it's been on the shelf a while, they kind of tuck it in back of the newer stuff. So it was a chance to kind of bring it to the audience again. What it was not, and what I want to be very clear about, it was not a chance to sort of convince people that bought the first one that I had a new book and they should really buy this one. Because in reality, though, I say it's a more mature version of the first one, it really is still the first book. It very much has the heart and the soul. I have not changed so much content that I would ever encourage people that already have the first one, unless the first one's getting so dog-eared and, you know, the margins are full of comments and stuff, which I hope is the case. I would say, you know, this one would be the one you would recommend to friends or buy as a gift for someone. But I would hate to think that people felt they had to go out and buy another copy because it was a new book. It really is not.
Got you. So, yeah, that's all great. I've got to admit that just because I know how much I enjoyed the first version, I'm probably going to pick up a copy of the second one anyway, just because I want to go through and see what's changed. But yeah, it's good that you're being totally sort of upfront about that and, maybe save a few people some money. But I personally think I'm going to grab another copy anyway.
I personally am totally okay with that, Mark.
I'll
buy you next time in Tokyo.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about your underwater work next. What I want to do is just to tell the audience, if you're listening to this and if you're listening to the Enhanced podcast, then the images will be there. But otherwise, go to mbp.ac/535 and you'll be able to see all of the images that we're about to talk about. So you've gotten into underwater photography. How long have you been doing it now? A couple of years?
Yeah, not even. I got my open water certification. I think I'm right in saying about a year and a half ago, when I was in Zanzibar, in East Africa. And I'd always said I wanted to do this, but I also always said there was no way in the world I was going to do it in Vancouver in a dry suit and murky cold water. Now I enjoy that kind of diving so much. I'm not sure why I was so so nervous, but it was a very nice way to learn how to dive. And since then, it's kind of caught me entirely by surprise. You know, I wanted just to get to go diving. Most of your listeners know that I had an accident 5 years ago and shattered my feet, et cetera, et cetera. There are a number of things that I just can no longer do. I don't walk the same and I don't move the same. And I'm not as comfortable as I once was, even with some of the technical hiking. Even if I could do it, I've sort of lost a little bit of my fearlessness. Mm. In fact, I get terrible vertigo just watching videos of people doing stupid stuff. So when I put my scuba gear on and I fall over the side of the boat, I have this incredible freedom that I don't have on land, you know, this weightlessness, but also I'm not reliant on what my feet can do. Mm. So that was sort of the thing that pushed me over the edge, so to speak. But the great surprise was how much I love being underwater, how much I love photographing underwater, and how friggin' difficult it is. Mm. It has been so challenging. You know, I think I went into it with this expectation that it will be just like it is above the water, but with, you know, a housing around the camera. And everything is different. Everything moves differently. Light works differently. You're trying to make photographs while also not dying. It's a significant challenge, which I really love. I love kind of chewing on something difficult and getting my teeth into something. So it really has been absolutely wonderful. Last couple months ago, I got my master diver certification or level or whatever, which was just kind of a way to push me to take a few more courses. And I'm just starting now. I've got 120 dives behind me and I'm starting to feel more comfortable. And I cannot tell you how exciting it is to be doing something both new, but so beautiful. I mean, as an example of that, when we look at these photographs, most of the photographs that I've given you are from a recent trip to Socorro, which is an island in an archipelago that's about something like 500 or 600 kilometers off the Baja coast of Mexico. And so you're in the absolute middle of nowhere and diving with sharks and giant oceanic manta rays, which are, you know, 15 feet across. And I mean, it was just absolutely magical and mind blowing. And I've always said, you know, you got to shoot what you love. And I found this new love affair underneath the water.
Wow. I can't wait to jump in and start looking at these with the audience, but you're scaring the hell out of me, David. You talked about falling off the edge of the boat, being pushed over the edge, and all of these things that are getting me scared. And having seen some of the precarious situations you put yourself in while we've traveled together, you're starting to scare me here. Stay away from edges, unless it's water below it, of course.
Edges are the least of my concern when I'm in the water.
This is good. So, you know, it is a dangerous environment. You've got to keep yourself alive, as you said, but for your gear as well. I mean, you need housing. What do you use for, not like a brand and things, but walk us briefly through the sort of gear that you have to prepare rather than just dunking your D800 in the drink.
Yeah, well, it has been quite a shock, I have to tell you. I went into this a little bit blind. You know, I just sort of thought, hey, you know, what would be really fun? Let's take the camera underwater. And then I bought a little Sony RX100 and the housing, and then I bought a strobe, and then I had two strobes, and then I realized all of that was well and good, but really for fast moving things like sea lions, it just was not the gear. And so I looked around and all my buddies were using D800s, and I thought, well, this is good. I've got my D800 and I bought a big bulky housing. I generally photograph with my D800 and up until now a Sigma 15 millimeter fisheye, which is a very popular lens with underwater guys. And so you need a big housing, which costs the earth. And then you need a like a lens port for your appropriate lenses. So, you know, you need a housing for your body, you need a port for your lens, and then different ports for different lenses. And then on top of that, you need, you generally speaking, although the images you're going to look at together are use ambient light. And I'm using ambient in these images, but I do also have strobes. And of course, you know, they're $2,500 each and they're big and heavy, and they're held out from the camera with metal arms and cables. And so you do lose some spontaneity in the sense that you can't just jump in the water. You've got to make sure the O-rings around the lens port and that seal the camera into the housing are all well lubricated with silicone, so they create a seal, and you've got to vacuum seal the housing, and then of course, you know, all of that rigmarole, and you better be darn sure that you've got a fully charged camera and you remember to put an SD card in the camera, because if you haven't, you have to strip it all apart, and it's a bit of a, you know, it's quite a process.
Yeah, sounds like it. So in some of the photos that we're going to look at, you went like into it, you know, into a portrait or a vertical orientation. Do the strobes, do they like rotate on the front of the lens? Can you flip them around, or are they fixed?
Yeah, they kind of out of each side of the housing, there's a handle, and on top of that handle, there's kind of a ball that clamps on, your armature clamps onto those, and you actually have quite a lot of flexibility with the strobes. Most of the time, to be honest, I shoot in horizontal mode and don't change where my strobes are, because it is such a, at least at this point for me, it's a lot of work to kind of reorient them and figure it out. And I'd rather keep them where they are. And because I'm shooting on the D800, for the few shots that I really want to be vertical, I will just crop them from the large D800 file into a vertical crop. But that's only if I'm using strobes. If I'm not using strobes, I'm quite happy to, you know, spin the camera every which way. And that's one of the freedoms, is when you're underwater so often, there's no horizon. So you can compose, as long as you don't kind of totally destroy the logic of the light and where it's coming from, you can compose in any way you want. You know, you can move in any way you want. You can look up and down, and you can shoot at 45 degrees, and there's no horizon that's kind of betraying the fact that you're creating a different story with the camera.
Excellent. That's all really interesting. I've snorkeled a couple of times and I've never taken a camera underwater. So it's all really sort of intriguing to me.
So it is fascinating. I mean, when I first started, I thought there's no way I want to use strobes, because you know I'm just not a strobe guy, and it never occurred to me that one, you just kind of have to when you get to a certain depth. There's just no light. But also, you know, especially if now the images we're going to talk about are black and white, so it doesn't entirely apply. But you know, when you get 20 feet under, you've lost most of the spectrum of light, and color disappears very, very quickly, and you're just left with blues and greens.
Yeah.
So if you want, and it's so vibrant under there, again, you won't be able to tell that from my images that we're looking at now, but the incredible colors. But if you want anything more than just a blue frame with blue things in it, or green in the northern waters, you need to bring strobes down. And of course, the light operates differently, and if there's any amount of particles in the water, you've got to angle your lights just so that you don't get as a lot of backscatter. You know, it hits these particles and bounces back, and then you've got to spend 3 days in Photoshop to get rid of them all. So you learn not to be lazy and to figure out your strobe placements pretty quickly.
Yeah, I remember being asked about this a few years ago, and I was thinking, well, it's got to be just a white balance tweak. But that's not how it works, is it? It's just, you know,
it's really not. I mean, a white balance tweak works when those things were hit with the full spectrum of light, and you're just changing it, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there. If it's not you can put a filter on the lens, and that helps somewhat. I mean, if you have a GoPro or something, you really can't filter. The front of my lens is about 10 inches across. It's a big, fat dome. You couldn't filter that. But ultimately, the only answer is to bring your light with you.
Mm, yeah, cool stuff. So let's start to look at the images. The first one that you've got here of the looks like seaweed. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, you're right. It's bull kelp, and it's pretty distinctly kind of cold water. It surrounds the waters that in Vancouver Island where I live. And this was my first big dive trip, and I went with some people that were profoundly more experienced than me. And actually, I went with two cameras. I went with my little Sony, and I went with my Fuji X-T1 and a brand new housing. And I was so excited I was going to get the Fuji underwater. And I got up there, and the housing was so poorly designed that I could, for example, the buttons were so imprecise, I could turn the camera off, but I couldn't turn it back on, which is really not helpful because it took so long to get the camera into the damn housing. And then to have to disassemble the whole thing, which you had to get at it, in order just to turn the camera on, was ridiculous. And I had it relied on a little pop-up flash, which I have on my Sony, but the Fuji, I just had forgotten there was no pop-up flash. And so I didn't have that little tiny one that gets included with the camera. So I got there and I had no way of turning the camera back on once it was in the housing. It was a bit of a pain in the ass to use. And then on top of that, I couldn't use my strobes. So I was forced to use this little tiny Sony and just kind of chill a little bit and work within the constraints. And so I focused mostly on things like seaweed. And I had so much fun just photographing the form and the grace of these kelp balls that were sort of, I don't know, maybe 15 feet or 5 meters from the surface, and just kind of hanging out. And I photographed other things, giant Pacific octopus and big wolf eels and stuff. But the images that I came out of that were actually quite simple, and really they were more like creative exercises to help me just kind of get my mind around shooting something artistically underwater, not just this is a photograph of an octopus, or this is a photograph of a... There's lots of illustrative pictures that are very easy to make underwater, but something that was compelling and artistic, I found really hard to wrap my brain around. And this was kind of the moment I realized, hey, I think I might be able to do this.
You can definitely see that. I mean, obviously, it's not the sort of image that I expected you to send initially, but in a good way. And it's very you. You know, you can tell that there's the creativity behind it. Also, the toning. I love the toning that you've done in all of these images. What was the reason for the black and white? Obviously, it looks beautiful, and there's, I'm not questioning that, but you know, what was the entire set that we're going to look at are all black and white. What's your thinking behind that?
You know, the longer I do this, the more important it is for me to not just do one nice photograph here and one nice photograph there. I want some cohesiveness in my work. I want them to, of course, that doesn't mean I want them to be homogenous. I don't want them to all be the same, but I want some element that runs through them, that binds them together, so that if, for example, I put them on a gallery wall, it would not feel like, it would feel united. And the thing that would be different would be the shapes and the mood and the feeling, but there would be something that kind of binds it together. Obviously, they're bound together thematically because they're underwater, but I'm playing more and more with the constraint of cohesion, if that makes any sense. So I do have, in the case of this particular image, these balls are a beautiful, almost a bronze color. So on its own, I have versions of these kelp that are lovely and are in color, but presented together, I feel like more and more I want my work to have that cohesion, so that it works. It's a body of work, not just, you know, as I said, one image here and one image there. I think that takes a while to get to a unified work rather than just sporadic stuff. You know, it's only now after 30 years that I feel I'm okay with saying, you know, I think it would be stronger as a series rather than it would be stronger as one image. To me, the series, what's the plural of series? The series.
Serai.
I think series is its own plural. Yeah. Stronger as a series, I'm willing to give up certain things on an image-to-image basis. Because again, you know, it's like a rock star. He can occasionally, not that I'm comparing myself to a rock star, but he could do an unplugged version of his song. Mm. And it, so there's, you know, there's two versions out there. There's the acoustic version and then there's the rock and roll one. I'm okay with there being two versions out there. Mm. But when I present them as a body, I want them to work together.
Yeah. And it definitely does that. It's great. The feeling across the whole set. I mean, I can almost imagine myself walking around a gallery looking at this stuff just as it is as well. But for sure, I think we as photographers, a lot of people tend to be a little bit binary. It's, and myself included, if you're going to do something, it has to be all or nothing. But there's definitely nothing stopping you from having a couple of different versions that you use, as you say. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to the second one with the seal, mm-hmm. or whatever this guy is.
Yeah, that's a stellar sea lion. These guys are actually quite close to my house. They're about a 3-hour drive, and seasonally they perch out on a little piece of rock in the middle of the water, and you know, they breed and they catch the herring and the juveniles, especially, which are the ones you want to play with, because these can be a fully grown sea lion. They're not like a Californian sea lion or some of the others. They are really big. A fully grown male sea lion can be bigger than a grizzly bear. Wow. And so the bulls would make me very, very nervous. But the juveniles, I mean, they're mischievous, they're curious, we're not even in the water yet, and they're swimming like crazy towards us, going, or, and they're like, you know, when are you getting the water? Can we play now? What about now? And they pester you. So we drop down to about 40 feet and we sit on the bottom and we wait for them to come in and explore us. All of our contact with anything underwater is at the initiative of the creatures themselves, and we sort of wait for them, generally speaking. I mean, you know, doesn't mean we won't sort of swim after them, but they are so fast. There's just no hope in the world of it being anything but at their initiation. So we sort of sit and wait, and they come and they chew on our hoses, and they kind of, you know, they chew on our heads. this last encounter, I had one, you know how once in a while a dog will come up and kind of cold nose you right in the crotch?
Yeah.
Well, I had one come up and just chomp me right in the crotch. I tell you what, I nearly drowned. It shocked me so much. So it didn't hurt, but it really startled me. And so I spent the rest of the dive kind of trying to cross my legs and protect myself with my housing. It made for some pretty dodgy photography, but it was really fun. Because it's so dark down there and the dome over the lens is so reflective, they come in and they look, like, get their nose right up to the dome, mm. and, you know, try to chew on it. And it's so much fun. And I don't know, there's just something, you know, this image is kind of, what I wanted to accomplish was some kind of portraits, you know, mm. something more intimate than just this is a sea lion. I have a lot of really terrible photographs of sea lions now, but only a few of them. The failure rate on this is just astronomical. They move so quickly, and trying to get the light dialed in, you know, the light normally falls off pretty quickly anyway, but underwater, it's, you know, if you don't get your light right, it's pretty unrecoverable. So you shoot a lot of frames and you stay down there as long as you can. And this just happened to be one of those moments where it just, all the stars kind of aligned and I got this really playful, but kind of, you know, I like to think of it as a fairly dignified photograph. You can see a little bit, I had rear curtain sync set and a slower shutter speed. So there's a little bit of motion in the tip of his nose. And that's the stuff that really excites me, is something that I don't just want to show people, this is what a sea lion looks like, because God knows there's plenty of photographs of sea lions out there. I want them to feel something about, you know, the encounters underwater and the magic and the wonder that I experience under there.
Yeah. You know, that's one of the things that I love so much about this photo is that movement that you've got there. And you've obviously, the strobes have frozen the guy perfectly, so it's totally sharp, but you've got that ghost of a motion around the nose. And that really shows you the sort of the dynamism and the fact that this guy, he's not just sitting there, he's whizzing around, and you've caught his head movement as he pulls it back there. But I also definitely feel the dignity that you talk about as well, and the vignette and everything, it just pulls your eye in. You're taking yourself down there as far as your style, and it feels so David, and yet it's just so different to everything that I've seen from you as well, in the fact because it's underwater and the subject matter, and I'm really enjoying this stuff.
Thank you.
So those white specks coming off his nose, is that air bubbles or what?
That's right.
Yeah. Oh wow. You almost don't think about the fact that these guys actually breathe air, because they're so free, and they're down there for so long without a tank on the back and stuff. It's hard to think until you see those little bubbles there that makes you think, oh yeah, these guys breathe air. It's a nice clue to their habitat.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You mentioned what was it? I've forgotten what I was. I've totally forgotten what I was going to say there for a moment. No matter. We'll move on to the next one.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about the next one, with the manta and the diver.
Yeah, and in fact, I'll tell you about the next two, because they're both very similar. They're giant oceanic mantas, so they're in terms of their brain size relative to their body size, they have the largest brain of any fish in the ocean.
Wow.
And they eat plankton, so clearly they didn't evolve this big brain so that they could chase down those wily plankton. What I think, just from watching documentaries and hearing people talk about these things, is that they developed this incredibly proportionately large brain to be social, and they're very social. They're very curious, and these particular mantas in this particular area, that they get these divers come in and swim in the middle of the ocean to be with them. And over time, they've learned to sort of, I guess, because they're curious and, the divers are all breathing bubbles. So these mantas come in and they play in the divers' bubbles. And it's just this incredibly, I don't even know if I have words to describe it. It is so magical. These things kind of come in like a ghost, and you turn around and there it is, and it's so in its own element, and you're kind of just barely staying alive.
Yeah.
And can and so clumsy, and they're so graceful, and they will on occasion they'll come right up and hover above you and kind of indulge in the bubbles. I don't know if they tickle or if they brush off parasites or what. Mm. But they're just very, they can be very friendly. Sometimes they'll pay no attention to you and just go on their way. Mm. But they're so graceful. So my first instinct when I was photographing them was the purity of the image, keeping just photographing the manta. But as I photographed them more, I wanted to tell a bit of a story, even if it was only for myself. I wanted to get a sense of the scale of these things, because scale is very hard to establish underwater. Mm. And so I started to include divers in the photographs. And, it's not a new technique. It was new for me only because I was trying so hard. I had this expectation that I would just get these photographs just of these mantas, when I realized, and I was trying really hard to get other divers out of the shot. Mm. Suddenly something kind of clicked in my brain, and I realized, no, actually putting the divers in is in line with my vision, because at least when I look at these photographs, I can put myself in the place of these divers and remember how big these mantas were next to me, and really the incredible, I don't know, like intimacy, magic, wonder of these experiences. And so again, now we're into photographs. Everything we look at from now on is completely ambient in the sense that I left my strobes off entirely and just exposed for the ambient light. And the second image in the series is probably my favorite. It has such scale to it. And the thing I love is that the waves above were kind of crashing on the shore of, you know, of this island. And it created this really, like the sky that you would see over Gotham City and, you know, in a Batman movie or something, this crazy apocalyptic sky. Yeah. That was the feeling of it. And so it felt more to me like we were not underwater, but just, I don't know, floating through an alien environment and flying through the sky. So there was something about it, and this manta kind of rolled over, and all of the rays have a very distinct pattern on their belly. They're all completely different. So you can actually identify these manta rays by the spots and the markings on their belly. And it was just sort of a different view of it. And I love the scale of this diver, who's a good friend of mine who I went down there with. But it was an unexpected image because, again, I was shooting with 15mm fisheye. You're always trying to get as close as you can. And it was a bit of a revelation to me that I could photograph almost an environment. Like, this is more of a landscape photograph with a manta in it than a photograph of a manta. And this is all a learning process for me. It was just this revelation, this moment of, oh, yeah, okay, I get it, right? Mm. It doesn't, you go down there and, yeah, it looks pretty, but you're looking for the thing, whatever the thing is, mantas, sharks, whatever. This time I went down and I was seeing the manta in the environment. And I think, you know, for those that are listening that have no intention of going underwater, this is something you learn topside as well. It's to look for a great background and tell a story and to do something more, not to be so seduced by your subject, which in this case I thought was the manta ray, that you're blind to other things. You know, maybe you tell the manta story better by backing off a little and giving it, you know, room to play and showing some scale and showing the environment. And that's probably the best way to get mood. But it took me a while to kind of, I know that when I'm not underwater. Mm. But like I said, bit of a learning curve. So I get underwater and I don't know, my brain just, maybe I wasn't getting a pure enough air or something. I need to put more oxygen in there, but I finally figured it out. It was just one of these learning moments.
Wow. And you know, that was what I'd started to say earlier and then forgot the split second later, but you'd mentioned earlier about how, you know, there's a lot of photographs out there that just document the you know, the undersea world and the wildlife down there. But you're taking, as I said, you're doing what you do, and you're telling stories, and you're building these images up, and I can almost hear the cogs turning as you know I've seen you work and how sort of methodical you are, but
easy for you to say,
but yeah, I can see the thought patterns here as well. And the first thing that I thought when I looked at the second of these was exactly what you've just said. It's a sky. It's almost a landscape, and yet you've got these figures that are floating in there, and it's very otherworldly. And at the same time, just it's so David Duchemin, and you know, you've really told the story, and I totally love this stuff.
Thank you.
So on the second one there, you've got the diver down the bottom of the frame, and then below that, it all starts to get pretty dark. Is this the natural drop-off of light, or is there a bit of processing there? Or, you know, and I'm not being critical. I'm just trying to understand what's happening in the photograph.
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. This entire series was photographed, was processed with Nick Silver Effects Pro. Again, in part because I wanted to treat all of the images with the same kind of treatment to kind of create or preserve some kind of unity running through them. So yeah, I couldn't tell you which preset I started with. Something kind of on the noir side. So it was very, you know, when I was photographing black and white as a teenager and young adult, it was all kind of real high contrasty stuff, in part because I was using crappy film. But, you know, I really like the T-Maxes and the Tri-Xs. And so when I was looking for a look, an aesthetic for these images, I wanted something that was quite dark. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of natural light fall off, but there's also some sort of simulated lens fall off on here. Mm-hmm. You know, I not a full, like a traditional vignette, but it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. Oh, it's beautiful.
It gets pretty dark pretty quick down there, to be honest. Yeah, so yeah. It's, you know, especially in the lower left, it gets pretty dark pretty quick. But yeah, there's a bit of kind of dodge and burn going on to bring the eye much more to the central characters and kind of create a heavier, moodier feeling.
Wow. You know, I was watching a documentary at the weekend here. Maybe it was a quiz show, but it's like a documentary style, and they ask questions about it. And there was a woman that had gone over to Iceland and was diving in some of the snow meltwater that is, you know, the fissure between the North American plate and the Eurasian plate. Uh-huh. Iceland is like the only place where you can see that above land, on, you know, above sea level. But there are also areas where the gorge just runs underwater, but it's fresh water, it's snow melt water. And it's, I think the woman that jumped in, she used a thermometer, she said it was 3 degrees. So it's really cold water. And it's so cold that there's no plankton down there. So there's virtually no light drop off. It's totally clear. And I can imagine you going up there as well. I mean, trying to get a trip in Iceland and do some of this work down there. Obviously, it's like dynamic range. I like dynamic range and the restrictions that we have right now, because I often like to plug up the shadows a little bit rather than trying to get every detail. You know, the shadows are what make the highlights stand out. And right. And so I enjoy that limitation. So I'm not sure you wouldn't get the same sort of work that you get in here, because the light drop off is so gradual and little compared to sea and where you've got plankton and other things in the water to actually stop the light getting through. But I'd love to see some of your work from those snow meltwater places.
You know, it's funny. I have thought about going and photographing there, and the only thing that stops me is the feeling that I wouldn't have anything to photograph. You know, there's no life. You know, I've wondered, would I just go and feel like I was doing the kind of the equivalent of architectural photography underwater, which is just, it's not my thing. Mm. But you're right, the water there is so clear, and I'm not afraid of, I mean, 3 degrees water is only a couple degrees colder than what we dive in here in the winter in Canada anyway. Except here we just have so much life. It's truly mind boggling.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'd not really thought of that, because obviously there's no plankton, there's nothing down there. So it would be just total landscape or seascape, but under it. That's a great point. So the next photograph, there's a weird-looking wildlife specimen in here. I imagine this is a selfie.
It's a profoundly self-indulgent selfie that I felt like I had to get out of the way. You know, once in a while you're on a dive and you're just not seeing much, or, you know, you want to test out your settings and make sure everything's good. And this was just a turn the camera around and get a few pictures of myself. But I don't know. Like I said, a profoundly self-indulgent self-portrait of the artist.
Yeah. It's great though. I mean, it shows obviously you're there with your apparatus. It shows what goes into this. And so I'm glad you included this. And also, you know, the fact that behind you, you've got the various layers of bubbles that are going up and all sorts of stuff. There's depth. It's a creative photo still. So I wouldn't, don't be so hard on yourself. It's
well, I enjoy it. I mean, you know, it's, I think one of the things I love so much about this stuff is that even on a day where there's nothing going on, there's still an adventure.
Yeah.
And you can still photograph, you know, other divers. And, you know, there's a very well-known early underwater photographer named well, he started the Brooks Institute, Ernie Brooks. Mm. And he has a beautiful photograph of just a large, they call it a diver's bell, you know, just the air bubbles all at a certain point, they join together and closer to the surface, you just get this beautiful kind of mercurial diver's, this half moon of a bubble rising to the surface, and it looks like a jellyfish or I mean, it's gorgeous. And he's got a photograph just of that, and it's a spectacular photograph. Yeah. The boat we were on this trip actually had Ernie Brooks prints on the walls of the staterooms and the dining hall and that sort of thing. And oh, it was spectacular to be surrounded by these beautiful black and white underwater photographs that were there were some sharks, but there were also divers and coral, and you know, this one image of a diver's bell we had that on the wall of our room, and it's a beautiful, there's so much possibility. You can do macro underwater, you can do landscape, you can do, you know, some version of portraiture, and it's really nice. It's nice to be photographing the water without feeling that I need to put my camera on a tripod and do a 30-second exposure.
yeah, I'm with you. Beautiful. So the next one, you've got this fish, looks like an inquisitive fish. I don't know what kind of fish, do you?
I have no idea. This thing followed me. He literally sat on top of my head for the first 20 minutes of a dive. Like he just, you know, if he wasn't touching, he was almost touching. And I could just, you can sort of, especially with my camera, I'll often swim with it sort of with the dome facing up, so that, because my vision is very limited underwater with the mask. But if the dome is facing up, I have sort of, it's like one of those security mirrors. Mm. So I can see in the dome, I can see if a dolphin is coming up on me, or if a manta's swimming above me or something. Mm. So I just swim like that and kind of keep an eye on things and make sure I'm not missing anything. It's a lot easier to do that than always be, you know, swimming and looking behind you, because the more you move, the more air you consume. And I saw this thing and I was like, what the hell is that? And he just stayed there. And finally I thought, right, all right, you cheeky bugger. I turned around and kind of, you know, sort of sunk down a bit. He didn't move. And I just fired off a couple shots. And as if totally finally satisfied, he just swam away. And it was just the goofiest experience. But there was, when I turned around and I saw him, I was so taken with the, you know, he was really ugly, actually. He had a really big forehead and goofy snaggle teeth. But these gorgeous, elegant lines coming off of his pectoral fins. Yeah. And just, there was something about him that was just this, you know, I don't know, this really ugly guardian angel or something. And it has become one of my favorite images from the trip. And I don't even know his name. I don't know what kind of fish it is. But it was something about these encounters, you know. You don't get it in the wild. You don't get, I mean, animals in the wild are so generally afraid of us. But underwater, we are so out of our own element that you get these really bizarre, intimate encounters that are quite disarming, really. Mm. And it also happens that in this case, he was also just visually, I thought he was quite striking.
Yeah, and I fully agree. It's just, and it's so cool that he's just in exactly the same position that he was when he was sitting on your head, and you moved and just sort of grabbed it, you know, captured this the way you did. And again, you've got that background with the waves crashing and everything. It's so dramatic, and yet there is a certain element of humor and again dignity. I feel as though he's, you know, he's proud to be there looking down at you, and it sort of, you know, whether he is or not, we tend to personify the subjects, especially wildlife, but you sort of read all sorts of things into this, and so I'm really enjoying looking at these. The next one, you've obviously I assume you've caught the top of the water there. You've got a bit of the outside world peeking into the top corner. And then these, you know, sharks, these things that we generally consider, if you see one, you swim quickly the other way, but you've obviously got a few photos with these. First, tell us a little bit about this one and the situation that you were in here.
Yeah, you've never, you've never been with a weirder group of people than dive photographers. I mean, I've always thought photographers were a little odd, and I throw myself in among them. But then you get with these dive photographers, and you know, someone says there's sharks off the back of the boat, and everyone jumps in the water. It's very counterintuitive, but you know, there are also people that that have spent a lot of time with animals under the water and are conscious of their behavior. And there's no predator-prey relationship with these particular sharks. They're maybe they're 5 feet long, the biggest of them. Mm. They're silky sharks. They're, you know, I think the thing I love about this photograph is the, and it's quite dark, but there's a little fish in the lower right.
Yeah.
And he just hung out. The sharks were not interested in him. He wasn't interested in them. I just caught them at this moment where it seemed like a very adversarial, you know, 3-1 kind of thing. But I was just for this shot, I actually had just come in from a dive, and they had said that there were silky sharks off the back of the deck, and I'd just taken all my gear off, and I really didn't want to get back in. So for this particular one and a couple of the others, I just lay on the back swim deck, which is right at water level, and I just stuck my camera underwater and sort of pointed at the sharks and just played. It was actually truly... I mean, I could see what was going on. I could see, you know, from the surface things. So I wasn't completely guessing, but there was a lot of luck involved. And there was just something. The light was so beautiful. There's another photograph we'll look at in a minute. That's, you know, you can see all of these rays just dropping down. We're probably in about 50, 60 feet of water, but it just went clear all the way to the sandy bottom. And it was just beautiful. And the nice thing about these cameras, when you got a really big front element, as you do with the dome of these things, you know, 10 inches across, it's very easy to sort of position it in a kind of a bit of an over under. And I like the feeling of this. To me, feels like it, you know, if you were in the water with sharks, and you were treading water, you know, there would be moments when the water would be kind of would feel like it was up around your eyeballs. And I like the immersive feeling of this. What I'm not trying to do with my photographs is make sharks look vicious. And we have feelings about what sharks are like. Mm. And obviously, you know, that's part of the storytelling of this, but you know, sharks are so misunderstood. And I hope eventually my work will be used in some way for conservation. You know, there's about 10% of the sharks left in the world. We're driving them to extinction, and a lot of it, and I, you know, this is going to come off as insensitive, but the reality is, as a global community, we can no longer afford a certain amount of grace to a culture, not naming names, you know, but China, yeah, that is shark finning. And yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of other rapacious practices by other cultures, but shark finning and the ivory trade are particularly popular in China. And it's, I hope that photographers now beginning to, well, and some of the greats have been doing it a long time, photograph sharks in ways that are not terrifying, that are graceful and elegant, and show them for, you know, for the incredible creatures they are. Because if we lose the sharks, the health of the oceans is in serious jeopardy, not just because they indicate that the oceans are in jeopardy, but because predators everywhere are incredibly important for the health of the food chain underneath them. And we're losing them, and we're just paying no attention. You know, it's the mighty dollar is winning because a culture has decided that they want, you know, a relatively tasteless soup. And it's just truly, truly tragic. So, you know, there's a bit of an agenda behind my wanting to learn this stuff. I do want to have a voice. I think, you know that I've been a humanitarian photographer for years. And I think one of the biggest, greatest, humanitarian tasks of our generation is to tend to our home, not just because it preserves the humans, but let's face it, if we screw this one up,
there's nowhere else
we're
to go.
In trouble, yeah. Right? And we are profoundly destroying. Now the Earth has an incredible ability to bounce back, but we're not allowing it to. You know, the manta rays, for example, manta rays get fished and they reproduce so slowly. Their gestation is about 13 months. They generally produce one pup at a time. We're fishing them faster than they can replace themselves. And you know, and they're never mind the compassionate reasons, never mind the fact that they have such a large brain and they're so social and creative. And so anyway, that's some of the, you know, the backstory. I mean, if we're going to talk about my vision behind this, this is the passion that drives it. It's not just for beauty, but for the preservation of beauty, you know, so this stuff will be around for future generations of people and of the creatures themselves.
Yeah. And that's a really powerful motive. I'm glad you brought that up. The finning that you hear stories, I've seen documentaries again, and yeah, and it's so inhumane, and the way, you know, they'll often just cut the fins off and then throw the struggling shark back into the sea to die. And you mm-hmm. know, I mean, honestly, we've killed animals to live since the birth of man. That's how we've lived, and I've got no problem with that. But the people of old, it's like the Ainu people in Hokkaido, when they killed a bear, they would use every piece of the bear. They would obviously they'd use the fur for clothing. They'd use the claws for tools. They'd use the bones to make things with, and obviously they'd eat all of the meat. And in the end, one of the beautiful things about the Ainu and the way their affinity with nature is, they would actually take the skull and climb the highest tree that they could find and put the skull in there to help it to go to heaven as quickly as possible. And it was kind of as a respect and a thank you for the fact that they'd taken the meat and they'd used the animal to stay alive. And yet you then see things like just whipping the fins off to eat that incredibly, like you say, bland soup and throw the rest away. It's just so wasteful and inhumane. It drives me crazy.
Well, it does drive me crazy. And, you know, we could talk about this for ages, but, you know, the Ainu people are a great example. There are lots of examples in First Nation cultures all around the world. Sustainability and respect and compassion are important to them. They could hunt the occasional bear with that kind of respect. And, you know, I mean, having spent a lot of time with bears, I find the idea heartbreaking, but I understand it. I have no tolerance whatsoever and no grace for the idea of trophy hunting. There's not a molecule of respect in me for that kind of behavior. And now that we have a world of 7 billion people, we need to completely rethink the way we do things. Just saying, well, you know, human beings eat meat, that's the way we do it. I'm creeping towards a vegetarianism that I never expected. You know, I prefer not to eat mammals anymore. But even if you're going to do that, you still have to look at, how am I eating? Am I eating responsibly? Am I eating sustainably? And can the earth actually afford that? There's no room for any other arguments. There's no room for, well, this is my culture. There's no room for, well, what if we put a particular kind of farmer out of work? We can't use that as an excuse to completely deplete this planet. And that is what's happening. You know, yes, we have a lot of cows. We're never going to deplete the planet of cows. But the fact that we have so many cows and are farming them globally in the way that we are, cattle farming costs, and I have nothing against cattle farmers, you know, per se, but the industry, that industry causes more pollution per year than all the cars put together on the planet. Wow. And uses more water to generate a pound of beef than is even remotely conscionable. So anyway, we're getting a long way off topic, but that's the concern and the passion that I have, not to preach, not to create a propaganda, because I don't think that's art. I think that's just propaganda. But I do want to use my images maybe to stir those conversations, but at very least to leverage some empathy in the human heart for this incredible world that we live in, and along with all the other voices, maybe contribute to a conversation about how can we do better, you know, as the most potentially helpful, but clearly the most destructive race on the planet. I think, you know, the only thing on this planet that reproduces purely for the sake of growth other than human beings seems to be cancer. And I'm not sure that that's a good comparison, but, you know, growth for growth's sake, you know. Anyway,
yeah,
I'm off topic. You want to talk about sharks? How about we talk about sharks?
So the next one that you mentioned earlier, these rays, this is spectacular with the, you know, the shark with the white underside and the black top. Tell us about this one.
This is just another in the series of I'm on the back of the boat photographing, you know, what I can see coming towards me. Now, remember, I'm photographing this with a 15 millimeter fisheye. Hmm. So they're quite close. They looked a lot closer to me when I was there than they do in the photograph. So I was just shooting from topside with my camera stuck in the water and kind of seeing what came and playing and hoping to God that the camera focused on something. sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. But, you know, this actually was a bit of a turning point for me in the trip where I kind of felt like I could just play and I didn't have to take it so seriously, and that I was coming back with a few images that, you know, that I quite liked. So this was just, you know, it was a silky shark coming to say hello. Mm. I think it was a silky shark. I'm not really good with my identification, but again, not a big shark, nothing, you know, nothing really scary, but there was something kind of archetypal about, you know, his position as he came up and that distinctive shark face and, you know, that grimace that I really loved. I did ask him to smile, but he was not into that.
What's causing the rays? Is that the sun up there and just as you would expect, or is there something else behind that?
Yeah, so this shark was, remember, I'm on the top of the water. I'm pointing my camera straight down into the water. The shark is coming straight up out of the depths. Mm. So this is just the light hitting the water and doing what light does in, you know, nice clear water. I'm not 100% sure any more than, you know, what the physics behind kind of those God rays, those crepuscular rays in the evening are. It just is light doing its thing.
Wow. Amazing. So the next one. This one, again, this felt very David to me with the, you know, the shark fin sort of right up close. I've seen this kind of work from you before. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I you're right. I love getting really close and really wide. Again, another in this same series, and he had come sort of straight at me and then turned around. And again, it's not as big a shark. I mean, this is not a 20-foot, you know, great white. This is like a 4 or 5 foot silky shark, very elegant and curious and playful. You can see from the bubbles that he's just been at the surface. In fact, in the top left, you can see a bit of the surface. Remember, it's a fisheye, so you get a bit of curvature. In fact, just after I shot this, he sort of, not intentionally, I don't think, smacked the camera with his tail. So he was very close. but again, I don't say that because, look at me, and it was very scary. It wasn't remotely scary, and there was no threat there. But the intimacy of these encounters and, you know, I love that long kind of the fact that the tail has become so big in the frame and occupies such a, you know, it becomes such a large graphic element, really kind of excited me. But again, it's that balance between knowing your craft, knowing what you're trying to accomplish, and then being totally open to the serendipity of it. Because there is really only so much you can do when you're, you know, got your camera stuck underwater and you're photographing moving sharks. So you try to frame it up and have lots of missed shots. And, but this just happens to be one of the ones where, you know, as his tail came in, I thought, oh, this is going to be neat. And, you know, I maybe got 5 or 6 really, really bad photographs, but I got the one that really kind of made me excited.
Yeah.
And I love the way, you know, he's pointing toward the left and there's this jack or whatever kind of fish. It's just pointing to the right. There's a contrast there that I really like, a bit of a juxtaposition, you know, predator and prey, small and large, you know, the shapes are similar, but different.
Mm, amazing. I love it. So the next one you've got, again, looks like you've got your camera half out the water. Tell us about this one as well.
I'm running out of things to say. It's a similar situation. I after I was playing with them, I thought, I got a few shots that I knew I liked, and I thought, let's play around with this over and under thing, because I've never been very good at it. Usually I'm floating in the water, and you know, it's harder than it looks unless the water's perfectly calm. And I haven't had the luxury of photographing or diving in really calm water much. So I was playing with, can I get some of the shapes in the water, or rather on the water, and get that sense of being on the surface while still getting a sort of a, it feels a little voyeuristic to me, sort of getting a peek under the water. And it just, it happened that I just happened for one frame to nail a shape. The water made a shape on the dome that I thought was quite elegant. And it happened to align with, again, this goofy fish that you would think he would be, you'd think he'd be out of there, but he was just hanging out with these sharks. And maybe there's something I don't know, again, about the predator-prey relationship with these sharks and these fish, but it just happened that that the elements kind of came together. But I love the shapes, and I love the contrast and the glimpse into that world without being under. I think it gives a little bit more context. I think that's what I love about that, other than just the elegance. You know, I think light on water is some of my favorite, just raw, natural, beautiful stuff. You know, you don't have to do much, and you just watch it kind of bend and refract and kind of do its thing. And it just happens that I think it works really nicely in this photograph.
Yeah. You know, for me, this almost feels as though it's the other way. The worlds have been switched, because the sharks, with them being down in the fish being down in the water there, that almost looks like he's floating against a clear blue sky. You know, with you've got those wispy sort of rays coming out there again. That feels to me like clouds. And it's as though we're looking up. If you flip this around, it almost feels as though you're looking up into the sky, with the air below the sea, rather than the opposite way around. It's a really sort of, I don't know, interesting look, the way it comes across. I know, obviously, because we see the water there, you can tell it's underwater, but it almost looks as though, with the clarity that you've got down below, it almost looks as though it's been flipped. It's really cool.
Interesting. I hadn't seen it from that perspective.
So the next one, again, a beautiful shot. Tell us about the manta there.
Yeah, I think these last three are among my favorite. This was just, to me, it was purely balletic. It was quite close, and then just started to kind of spin and move. And I don't know, there was a moment where the one pectoral fin or wing kind of wrapped around the front, and the other moved the, and it was one in a series of burst photographs that happened to catch the elegance in a way that I think really just kind of expressed it. It's a very simple photograph. In fact, the only thing that I alluded to earlier, where, you know, there's no horizon, so you can kind of play with this. The manta was not as vertical as this. In fact, over vertical. But I just turned the camera and oriented it so it appeared that way. But there was just something, you know, just purely graceful about it. I can't describe this. This has become one of my favorite images from the year. Something so purely playful. Yeah. You know, I think it's, I don't think that anthropomorphizing animals, you know, making them to be like us is helpful. But I also don't think it's inappropriate to suggest that, not that they are like us, but that we share common traits. That, you know, if I say a manta is curious, I'm not anthropomorphizing in the sense that I'm saying they're like man. I'm saying there are things we share. And for a long time, I think, you know, we, especially those of us from the West who share some kind of, you know, Judeo-Christian background, kind of believed that man was at the top and we were the pinnacle of creation. And that, worse than that, you know, animals had no soul, and there was all kinds of things that we began to believe and act upon that now I reject and say, you know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with saying a creature has curiosity. It may not be the same as ours, but they are playful. They do love. Anyone that's had a dog knows that a dog loves and has affection. Again, I'm not suggesting it's the same as ours, but there are some very smart creatures on this planet.
Without doubt.
I'm okay saying that we are not the absolute pinnacle. In fact, this manta ray will do an awful lot less harm than most human beings ever will.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they animals. I just read an article today that humpback whales are getting, and there's a lot of recorded incidents, they are getting in the way of orcas who are hunting. Now, orcas or killer whales often will, you know, well, I mean, they kill things, but they will often kill smaller whales like a humpback calf or, you know, the calf of a gray whale. And scientists are now recording these humpback whales going in, and I don't know if this is vigilante justice or an act of compassion or altruism, but they're actually going in and preventing these hunting orca from killing their prey. And it's to me, it's astonishing because we're looking at these creatures that are potentially exhibiting more compassion and altruism than, you know, than we often do. Yeah. So anyway, there was something in this this display, and it doesn't do it justice. The way they move and the grace, and it just, this was one of the most magical moments of my life, and in a trip that was full of the most magical moments of my life. I'm going back again in December, and then I'm going back again in sometime in the spring, early summer next year to photograph, because I am so hooked on how beautiful, even if I didn't have my cameras, how truly magical and beautiful. And everyone, I think everyone should be able to experience the wild as I'm experiencing it. You know, I think if we could, maybe one of the reasons that we're so flippant about the way that we treat our environment is because we don't really know what we're doing, you know? Like a lot of people, you know, their meat comes from the grocery store, and beyond that, it's all kind of a mystery. I think if people really understood, they would at least be more capable of making responsible decisions, or at least intentional decisions. You know, I don't want to say everyone should eat one way or the other, but certainly everyone, I think we have a duty to eat responsibly and sustainably. Anyway, getting back onto my sermon, the next image after that was, one of the more magical kind of moments. It just, you know, the light was coming down. I have a color version of this, which I'm torn about because it's so beautiful that this very much works in black and white. But the color version is also the colors, the blues and the aquas are just so striking. Wow. There's an awful lot of chromatic aberration in the hottest spots of this image. So it's a little easier for me just to sort of go, you know, I think I'm okay with leaving this as a black and white. But it's just one of those moments when I was coming up, after you've been diving a while, you always stop at 5 meters or sorry, five meters or 15 feet. Just you hang out there for 3 minutes just to kind of let some of the nitrogen in your blood kind of off gas. And it's we call it a safety stop. And I had come up to do my safety stop, and I was just floating in 15 feet of water and kind of looking around. And 3 minutes it can be a really long time when you're just kind of looking around. And suddenly there was this manta floating by. And so at that point, all bets were off. My safety stop was, I was off to photograph again, and then I had to go back and resume, you know, like do my safety stop again. But it's amazing when you're just floating in nothingness and you turn and you see something that is just so unbelievably graceful. I mean, just incredible. And then I came to the surface, and one of these brown boobies, kind of like a fishing bird, came by and completely strafed us with bird shit. It was like, there's gratitude for it, you know? And you come up from such a magical experience, and you're thinking of the world as a magical place, and how, you know, and then this bird just, and not a gentle, I mean, it just came by and napalmed us. It was spectacular.
And I guess those guys eat fish, and it's not the best sort of substance to be having all over you.
It was it was kind of gross.
but
you know, we were floating in the water, so any, you know, you can wash it off, so no harm done. But it was, you know, you kind of, You're feeling one with nature, and then nature crapped all over you.
Brilliant. Yeah, these last two, they're both so graceful and beautiful. And yeah, I'd love to see the color, but I think as part of this cohesive set, this is just, it's almost like each one builds on the previous image. And the rays and everything, I love both of these. I love all of them. The last one, you've come back to the human element for this last one that we're going to look at. Just to finish, let's talk a little bit about this one.
Yeah, this was not on that last, on the dive of the last one, but similar. And it was just, during safety stop and, I believe it was, I actually don't recall, but, diver heading to the surface, and what you see in the hand is the dome of the camera housing pointing up, catching the light. And I loved how the light just hit just a lick on the diver's mask and on the housing, and coming up from the depth into the light, there was just something really, I don't know, and maybe it's the kind of an image that, that only a diver kind of gets. I don't think so. I think something mysterious and adventurous about it, but diving is such a, my experience of diving has been just such an incredible window into a mysterious world, that some of this feeling, of the diver coming up, and it's hard to see. If I were printing this again, I would lighten some of the shadows just a hair, because the diver's fin on one of his feet is just sort of really gracefully looped under, and so it creates this really beautiful little arc. And I don't know, it's just as clumsy as diving is above water, and often underwater, there are these moments of grace where it just, I don't know, it's graceful but yet adventurous, and it's hard for me to explain, and maybe it's why I just resort to my photographs and sort of hope that they capture something of the experience.
I'm totally with you. I mean, the grace, it fits right in there with the mantas and the other photos, and the things that you mentioned there, that obviously what really make this image such a pleasure to look at, the fin, the flipper there, and all of the light, and the fact that the diver is almost totally black against that sort of mid to dark gray, just the contrast, and then you've got the huge amount of contrast at the top with the light, and again it almost feels like a sky. I can get lost in these photographs. And I want to thank you for, obviously we've run over a little bit time-wise, but thanks so much for sharing these images and your backstories and that with us today, David.
Well, you're absolutely welcome. Thank you for letting me and giving me. I think sometimes when we do these things, we sort of, as photographers, I don't think we talk about, we like to talk about how we made it, but we so seldom just talk about the photographs, and it's really refreshing just to have a conversation, yes, a little bit about how we did it, and it's relevant, but more just about the experience, and I'm grateful that you gave me that chance.
Not at all. It's been my pleasure. So I doubt that anyone doesn't already know this, but just to finish, tell us where people can find you, David. Online.
Usually at about 660 feet underwater. online. My blog is at davidduchemin.com. You can also find photographic resources from my publishing house, my resources and Martin's at craftandvision.com. And you can find me in all the other usual places. I'm on Instagram and Facebook and a little bit less on some of the social media these days. But you can get all of that at davidduchemin.com. There's all kinds of links and stuff to my YouTube show and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, excellent. Well, yours is probably one of the few blogs, probably the only blog that I ever really visit anymore. You're always, the eloquence that you put into your books and things, it's there in every post as well. So I always enjoy reading your stuff. And
well, thank you.
Not at all. So once again, thanks very much. A little bit long, but I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope the listeners do too. I'm sure they will. But thanks, David, and hopefully we'll catch up again soon.
You're very welcome.
Okay, well, that was, as usual, a lot of fun. I always enjoy speaking with David, and I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I have just one little bit of housekeeping to mention before we finish. Although totally unrelated to this post, I wanted to quickly mention that last week I published my Canon EOS 5DS R settings on the blog, for those of you that are interested. I have been asked to share my settings a number of times to get people up and running quickly with the camera, so I thought I'd just share what I consider to be my most important customizations right here on the blog. You can check out those settings in that post at mbp.ac/5dsrsettings, all one word, all lowercase. And I'll put a link into the show notes for this post, which again is at mbp.ac/535. Thanks very much for listening today. If you enjoy this podcast, please share a link with your friends. And if you don't already, please subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast program to ensure uninterrupted delivery. If you have a moment to rate the podcast or leave us a review in iTunes as well, that really helps to keep us relevant in the huge number of podcasts out there now. You can find me on Google+, Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, etc. And links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com, so do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with another episode, but in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you do. Bye-bye.